Gopinatha Shama Kundarakam Nijibhagavatam Ki Jai. Jantaraj Shrimad Bhagavatam Ki Jai. Gaura Pimanandi. One nice thing about this virus is that we've all unknowingly become followers in the line of Narottam Das Thakur, who introduced Manasa Seva. So we're all having to perform so many different types of Manasa Seva. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. I'm going to do some shortcuts this morning because I have three verses to cover and a Lila Acharya pastime. So, Saheva Jiva Lokasya Maya Mohita Chetasa Vidhaste Svena Viryena Srihu Dharmari Lakshanam Tatahyam Chavatarasti Bhuva Bara Jihirasya Svanam Chanaya Bhavanam Anudanaya Chakshashri Kakrit Anudyanaya Chasakrit Kim Idam Svit Kuta Viti Deva Deva Navidyaham Sarvata Mukamayati Tejo Paramadarunam. Srimad Bhagavatam, first canto, 7th chapter, verses 24, 25, and 26, translations. And yet, though you are beyond the purview of the material energy, you execute the four principles of liberation characterized by religion and so on for the ultimate good of the conditioned souls. Thus, you descend as an incarnation to remove the burden of the world and to benefit your friends, especially those who are your exclusive devotees and are constantly wrapped in meditation upon you. O Lord of Lords, how is it that this dangerous effulgence is spreading all around? Where does it come from? I do not understand it. The personality of Godhead, Sri Krishna, out of his causeless mercy, descends in the manifested world without being influenced by the material modes of nature. He is eternally beyond the material manifestations. He descends out of his causeless mercy only to reclaim the fallen souls who are captivated by the illusory energy. They are attacked by the material energy, and they want to enjoy her under false pretexts. Although, in essence, the living entity is unable to enjoy. Really strong statement. You can't enjoy. One is eternally the servitor of the Lord. And when he forgets this position, he thinks of enjoying the material world. But factually, he is an illusion. The Lord, that's worth repeating. One is eternally the servitor of the Lord. And when one forgets this position, he thinks of enjoying the material world. But factually, he is an illusion. The Lord descends to eradicate this false sense of enjoyment and thus reclaim conditioned souls back to Godhead. That is the all-merciful nature of the Lord for the fallen souls. It appears that the Lord is partial to his devotees. Everyone is related with the Lord. He is equal to everyone. And yet, he is more inclined to his own men and devotees. The Lord is everyone's father. No one can be his father. And yet, no one can be his son. His devotees are his kinsmen, and his devotees are his relations. This is his transcendental pastime. It has nothing to do with mundane ideas of relations, fatherhood, or anything like that. As mentioned above, the Lord is above the modes of material nature, and thus there is nothing mundane about his kinsmen and relations and devotional service. Anything that is presented before the personality of Godhead should be done so after due presentation of respectful prayers. That is the standard procedure. And Sri Arjuna, although an intimate friend of the Lord, is observing this method for general information. Om Jnana Timadandasya Jnanjana Shalakaya Chakshur Unmanitam Yinatasmai Sri Gurave Namaha Mukam Karoti Vachalam Pandum Lam Jayati Girim Yakripa Tamaham Vande Sri Gurum Dinitharina Vansha Kopa Turubhyascha Kripa Sindhivahe Vacha Patitanam Pavani Dio Vaishnave Dio Namo Namaha Jaya Sri Krishna Chaitanya Prabhu Nityananda Sri Advaita Sri Radha Sri Vasudeva Gaura Bhakta Vrinda Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare. Namaste, Divi Raja, Yashi, Bhogadana, Namine, Aseisha Klesha, Nashaya, Paramananda, Dhani, Aseisha Klesha. This chapter 7 of the first canto describes the heinous act of Drona's son Ashwatthama. And this action that he's performed is really the true function of the material energy of the Lord working on an individual so that that person would think that by killing the sons of Draupadi while they were sleeping and then beheading them and then taking those heads in a bag or a platter, it doesn't describe, but you can let your imagination imagine how he transported them, to his father, who, although the father fought on the side of the Kauravas, was nonetheless seen as a respected acharya, and presenting them to him in a great mood of pride. This is the illusory energy, that someone could do something like this, which in every aspect of that description is the most horrific act. What to speak of all of them combined, and this is how the illusory energy allows one to think, yes, what I did was very good. So this type of action that Ashwatthama has performed, it goes against all moral, it goes against all battlefield codes, it goes completely against the codes of all Kshatriya behavior. Now the purpose of this was to cause great pain and suffering the Pandavas. Who would suffer more from this than anyone, of course, is Draupadi. And we know Draupadi was extremely dear to Lord Krishna, a very saintly woman, daughter of King Drupada, sister of Drishtadyumna, such a very wonderful family connection, married to all five of the Pandavas. And matter of fact, I think one of the few, if not only, women in Vedic history to have such an explanation, a situation. So I thought it was worth visiting a bit of her background in this chapter, since she is a pivotal point. And, I mean, I can't remember what it was. Prabhupada talks about this one great Bengali author that wrote a book titled so-and-so, but the character in the book was actually someone else. Prabhupada lectures on this a couple of different times. Yes. But that's not actually the main character, but the main character is... So in this chapter, it appears the main character is the discussion with Vyas and Sutta and Sukadeva and, you know, the Ashwatthama's horrible. But the real underlying character in this chapter is Draupadi. Because without her loss of the sons, without her grief, without the commitment Arjuna makes to her, the chapter has a hole in it. So Prabhupada mentions a little later in the Bhagavatam, in this first canto, 13th chapter of the Bhagavatam, Prabhupada does some wonderful historical biographies on each of the different individuals in that chapter mentioned. And about Draupadi, I think it's appropriate to read what Prabhupada says here. The most chaste daughter of Maharaj Drupada, and partly an incarnation of the goddess Sachi, the wife of Indra, Maharaj Drupada performed a great sacrifice under the superintendence of the sage Yaja. By his first offering, Drishtadyumna was born. And by the second offering, Draupadi was born. She was therefore the sister of Drishtadyumna and is also called Panchali. The five Pandavas married her as a common wife, and each of them begot a son in her. The interesting scenario. The pontiff has gone out collecting alms. This is when they were in hiding and came back. Mother, will you have alms? So, all right, you all share it. And, of course, I'm shortening the story a bit, but the word of Kunti could never be broken. So all you all share. So, therefore, married to all five of the Pandavas. The five Pandavas married her, and each begot a son in her. Maharaj Yudhishthir begot a son named Pratibhit. Bhishma Singh begot a son named Suttasoma. Arjuna begot Shrutakirti. Nakula begot Satanika. And Sahadeva begot Shrutakarma. She is described as the most beautiful lady, equal to her mother-in-law, Kunti. During her birth, there was a divine message from the sky that Prabhupada uses the word actually here, aerial message. This is at a time where if you got a letter from Prabhupada, it came by aerogram, a regular envelope that was sent in the mail, but it had the words aerogram printed on it because this is going to be sent by airmail, not cross-country. An aerial message that she would be called Krishna. The same message also declared that she was born to kill many a Kshatriya. I don't know, but as a father, you know, maybe not what you want to hear, a divine message from the sky about your daughter. Yes, you have a wonderful daughter and she'll be the cause of many kings' death. By dint of her blessings from Sankara, she was awarded five husbands, all equally qualified. When she preferred to select her own husband, princes and kings were invited from all over the countries of the world. She was married to the Pandavas during their exile in the forest. But when they went back home, Maharaj Drupada gave them immense wealth as a dowry. She was well received by all the daughter-in-laws of Dhritarashtra. When she was lost in a gambling game, she was forcibly dragged into the assembly hall, and an attempt was made by Dushyashana to see her naked beauty, even though there were elderly persons present like Bhishma and Drona. She was a great devotee of Lord Krishna, and by her praying, the Lord himself became an unlimited garment to save her from the insult. A demon of the name Jatasura kidnapped her, but her second husband, Bhimasena, killed the demon and saved her. She saved the Pandavas from the curse of Maharaj Durvasa by the grace of Lord Krishna. When the Pandavas lived incognito in the palace of Virata, Kichaka was attracted to her exquisite beauty, and by arrangement with Bhima, the devil was killed and she was saved. I like the way Prabhupada in this descriptive purport, because you know, the history of Draupadi, you could spend five or six classes speaking about each of these incidents. And he just gives a little sentence. Okay, you know the story, you don't know the story, we're moving on to the next one. So it gives a little taste. Okay, oh, I have to go find out about this. So she was very much aggrieved when her five sons were killed by Ashwatthama. At the last stage, she accompanied her husband Yudhishthir and others and fell on the way. The cause of her falling on the path to heaven was explained by Yudhishthir, but when Yudhishthir entered the heavenly planets, he saw Draupadi gloriously present there as the goddess of fortune. So this background serves to give us an even deeper understanding of what a horrible act it is that Ashwatthama has performed. He's committed this not only just horrific thing, but against a personality like Draupadi. Faultless, dear devotee of the Lord, respected by all, wife of the Pandavas. So many wonderful things to say. In every scenario of her life, when there is a challenge or a difficulty, she's saved. This doesn't happen to ordinary people. So, for Ashwatthama to step forward and do this, just it's such an example of the illusory energy. Yes, this will gain me fame. I will please everyone, especially my father. Here, have the heads of these five sons. But this current chapter we're in, chapter 7, doesn't really go down this road of this particular pastime with Ashwatthama until we get to verse 12. The first 11 verses of this chapter are all glorification and praise of the sages who were involved in the process of the presentation of the Srimad Bhagavatam, and the glorification and results of hearing the words of the Srimad Bhagavatam. In particular, verse number 7 is especially nice in this chapter, especially in this first 11 verses of prayers. Yasyam vaishrut yamanayam krishne parama purushe bhaktir utpadyate pumsha soka maha amoha soka moha vayapaha. Simply by giving oral reception to this Vedic literature, the feeling for loving devotional service to Lord Krishna, the Supreme Personality of Godhead, sprouts up at once to extinguish the fire of lamentation, illusion, and fearfulness. Lamentation, illusion, and fearfulness. Three qualities that many of us are personally associated with, are familiar with at the least. So I thought in looking at that particular verse, number 7, it reminded me how this verse is so important in the troubled times that we find ourselves in, both personally and collectively as a society in our modern world. Whether it is disease, whether it is social injustice, whether it is political divisiveness, all of these things are extinguished by the process of hearing Srimad Bhagavatam. These things, they place us into this fire of lamentation, this fire of illusion, this fire of fearfulness. Now, fire's nature is to burn. Sometimes when we're doing the different homas, I go to put something in. If I'm not quite careful enough, I burn the hairs on my arm. It's happened numerous times. And you pull back because of... Now, that's just a very slight little touch with the fire. Prabhupada gives the wonderful example of the child and the fire. The child has no understanding of the fire. The mother's warned, no, no, don't touch. Hot, hot. The famous parent line to the children. Hot, hot. One of the first words the kids learn. Hot, hot. So they know, don't touch, don't touch. But the child touches. The fire is indiscriminate. The fire is not thinking, oh, this is a little boy. I'm not going to harm him. He doesn't know any better. Wait till the adult comes who knows better. I'll burn them twice. No, the fire doesn't think like that. The fire has one purpose, that is to burn, to devour. So regardless of what comes in contact with it, it will burn and devour. So depending on how intense that fire is, will determine the intensity of what is devoured. Paper devours in a very slight thing. You have a little bitty match, you put it to paper, the paper is gone. You take that same match and put it to a piece of steel, it's not going to have any impact. If you have a very intense fire, sometimes big buildings burn up and they say, the fire was so hot it melted the steel girders. So the intensity of the fire of lamentation, the intensity of the fire of illusion, the intensity of the fire of fearfulness will determine how badly we're burned and how long we stay in contact with that fire. Now, the intelligent person, the minute they touch it, they pull their hand back. It's a reflex. Ow! You know? There's one Russian devotee. He's a very expert actor. He's actually a pantomimist. And he just released one little video in full pantomime costume and all, where he's drinking a tea, and the cup of tea is just extremely hot. And that's our natural reaction when we get close to something that's going to burn us. But here, under the illusion of the material energy, we're embracing this fire of lamentation, of illusion, and of fearfulness. So what could be said about us? We're very foolish. But according to the seventh verse, if we simply hear the message of Srimad Bhagavatam, which will cause the loving devotional service for the Lord to sprout within our heart, it will be extinguished. Completely extinguished. Earlier this year, this is a little late right now because it's so hot, but we would see, I got some seeds. I decided to put a flower bed in at my house and got the right soil and divided it all off, a little brick, and put the flowers in and watered very devotedly. And within 2 or 3 days, little sprouts came up. And now they're all like this tall. So just with very little effort, those sprouts came up. Similarly, with very little effort of oral reception of the message of Srimad Bhagavatam, the sprout of love of God can manifest in our heart. It's such an important thing to do. So these types of devotional practices, they manifest love for Krishna. And because of that manifestation of love for Krishna, the devotional practices in our heart become firmly rooted. And this is, of course, the solution to all of our problems. So, I mean, it's such a simple thing. So we should always embrace verses like the seventh verse here. You know. So, on to today's verses. Now, in text 24, there's a very clear explanation given of the difference between our appearance or birth, whichever word you want to use, in this world, and the Lord's appearance in this world. He comes to this world without any influence of the three modes of material nature, without any karmic reaction determining the type of body he gets, without any need to work off past sinful activities, and without any false understanding of his identity. None of these things impact the Lord's decision to manifest himself by his own sweet will here within this world. We, on the other hand, these four things completely determine how we're going to manifest, what type of circumstance we're going to manifest in, and how much difficulty we're going to encounter in that circumstance. Completely the opposite scenario of how the Lord manifests himself. Now, the Lord could leave us here to learn our own lesson, hopefully. Not everybody learns their own lesson. But, you know, he's perfectly satisfied. It's not like he's sitting up there saying, oh, where's my Chaturatma? I'm missing him so much. I'll have to go down and get him. It's not like that. You know, the Lord is completely self-satisfied and in the association of so many wonderful servants. But he has great concern for all of the living entities, who, as his verse says, he is the father of. So he's concerned. Now, you know, he could eventually wait until we burn out our material desires, but that's the problem. We don't burn out our material desires. We go back to the fire. When the jug of fire is going, if I put more and more wood and more ghee, the fire is going to continue, and it's going to intensify. By adding fire, by adding ghee to the fire, it doesn't diminish. Matter of fact, when the fire is starting to go a little bit too small and you've still got half the ceremony to go, you put more wood and more ghee and it flames back up. So the idea of burning out our material desires isn't logical. I'll just pursue sense gratification and eventually, you know, I'll be tired of it. It doesn't work that way. So in this way, that's not a solution. But by Svena Viryena, or as Prabhupada translates those two words, his causeless mercy, he comes here to this world to deliver us. The Lord comes here. Doesn't have to come here, isn't required to come here, but by his causeless mercy. I believe the actual Sanskrit in this is his influence. Prabhupada translates it by his causeless mercy. The Lord steps into this muckety muck, if you will, of the world simply for the purpose of our salvation. Now, sometimes in a book or in a film presentation or something of this nature, the hero gets trapped. Or the people the hero's rushed in to rescue, they're all trapped. And there's only one way out. They have to jump into the sewer. You know, they pull the grate. We've all seen it or heard it or read it. Pull the grate out and jump into the sewer. And there's great complaint about being, oh, this horrible sewer thing. But it's the only way out. You know, and they walk through it until they get to safety. This is where we're at. We're in that sewer. And the Lord willingly steps in to deliver us. No one willingly steps into the sewer. Well, unless you're foolish 12-year-old boy, like I was, I had friends when I was growing up. They were a rather adventurous crew. And for some reason, we got the idea to climb down into the sewer holes, you know, the drainage on the sidewalks there, and follow it, because we knew it came out at the end of the football field. I don't know what, you know, but there we were, five or six of us, slipped down into the manhole and going along here, and it was not a very pleasant situation. I mean, it wasn't an open sewer like you'll find in some places in the world, but it was not a pleasant scenario. I never did it again. They all thought it was such great fun, and I thought they were crazy. But the Lord has willingly come into such a situation simply to deliver us. It's a commonly used theme, and it's very symbolic here, that this is how we should see that we're in that very difficult, horrible place that we're calling home, namely this material world. And the Lord, shaking his head, all right, I will manifest. These fools, they're so trapped, they will not understand anything unless I personally come to save them. Now, sometimes the Lord will come in his Lila incarnations. Sometimes the Lord will come indirectly in a variety of other types of incarnations. But when he comes, it is only for one benefit, and that is to show his supreme love for us. Now, in that first purport, Prabhupada says, quote, the fallen souls are captivated by the illusory energy. They are attacked by the material energy, and they want to enjoy the material energy under false pretext, although in essence, the living entity is unable to enjoy. And there's a wonderful use of words, trying to enjoy under false pretext. Prabhupada uses a classic example of the hand. The hand has a purpose, that is to serve the mouth. The hand serves the mouth food, the food then serves the body, its digestion, and so on. If the hand decides, no, I'm not serving anymore, the mouth can't force the hand to serve. No, I'm telling you, you have to serve. No, I'm not going to serve. So the mouth has no influence to force the hand to serve. But by not serving, the hand's position becomes totally diminished. As a matter of fact, destroyed eventually. Because by the hand not surrendering and serving the mouth, there will be no nutrition. The body will not digest the food. The body won't become strengthened. The hand won't be able to function. So this is a very clear example the Prabhupada uses. The Lord doesn't force us to surrender. But if we don't surrender, we have no real purpose. We have no real satisfaction. The pleasure that we're trying to enjoy under false pretext won't be satisfying. Prabhupada's analogies are so wonderful. You take a look at them, everything is very clear. Verse 25. Now, this verse, the next verse, contains the real secret as to why the Lord would bother to come to this sewer world to save us. Quote, to benefit your friends, especially those who are your exclusive devotees and are constantly wrapped in meditation upon you. This is our goal. We want to be, if not in all, at least one of these three categories. The friend of the Lord, the exclusive devotee of the Lord, and constantly meditating on the Lord. We should give our life in such a way that we're living in a manner that the Lord looks upon us and becomes very satisfied. Oh, there's my friend. Oh, there's my exclusive devotee. Oh, they're always meditating upon me. This is what we desire to do. And we have this in our family or friends or someone. We have someone we'll do anything for in the nature of our relationships. If we give up anything for, that we would go anywhere for. The relationship like that, it's not just a physical bond, it's an emotional bond. And we can understand how how that person or persons looks at someone else, you can understand what's in their heart for that person. We don't have the eyes to see it, but when we come before the deity of Radha Shyam Sundar, they're very happy to see us. They're looking at us with great love and affection. So when we have a relationship like that, This is what allows us to come into the category of being the friend, of being the exclusive devotee, of meditating on the Lord like this. And this is how we have to truly hope to be as devotees. This should be our aspiration, one of these three categories. Now, someone might think, well, this is kind of a new age idea, you know, just love and, you know, just be, you know. But this is exactly what Rupa Goswami describes in his Upadeshamrita. Tathati pratigrinanti, guyam ayati prichati, bhunkte bojayate kaiva, sat vidham priti lakshanam. The offering of gifts in charity, the accepting of charitable gifts, the revealing of one's mind and confidence, inquiring confidentially, accepting prasadam and offering prasadam, these are the six symptoms of love shared by one devotee and another. Now, in the purport there, Srila Prabhupada says, even in ordinary social circles, there are six types of dealings between two loving friends that are absolutely necessary. Whenever there is a dealing of priti, or love, in intimate dealings, there are six activities that are executed. In the previous verse, Srila Rupa Goswami advised that one should renounce worldly association and keep company with the devotees. The International Society for Krishna Consciousness has been established to facilitate these six kind of loving exchanges between devotees. Don't think that we're not supposed to love each other. That's why Prabhupada established ISKCON, to develop loving relationships between devotees. Make no mistake about it. The Lord is very clear in this verse that we have to love Him and that we have to love each other. Now, there's a statement in this purport. Prabhupada says, opens the door for another amazing analogy that he uses. He says, the question is posed, is Krishna partial to His devotees? And as it says in the purport, He is equal to everyone, and yet He is more inclined to His own men and His own devotees. So is He to be faulted for that? There was one, it was either a room conversation or a morning walk, we probably was discussing this point. And so he gave the example. Suppose there's a fire. And the fire is in a building, and there are two, three, four children in the building, whatever, some children. And the man runs in, but he has only the ability to save one child. He doesn't have the ability to save more than one child. He can only save one child. So he saves his own. Can he be faulted? Oh, you saved your own child. How can he be faulted? Prabhupada uses this example to show how Krishna, of course, is equal to everyone, but He is more inclined to His devotees. So it's in our best interest, to behave in such a way that we fall into one of these three categories. Because if we behave in that way, if we fall into those categories, then Krishna will be very much inclined to us. And this is what we want in Krishna consciousness. This is why we chant. This is why we read. This is why we perform tapasya. This is why we associate with the devotees. This is why we do everything we do to gain the favor of Krishna. So that sometime He will reach down and pluck us out of this world and take us back to His lotus feet. Now, verse 26. Personally, myself, I would have just, with these verses here, had these first two verses and then put this, because this verse 26 takes us to a new subject matter, to a new direction, but in the purport, Prabhupada kind of pulls it together here. You'll see what I mean. So, in this verse, Arjuna is seeing the intimate nature, we're seeing the intimate nature of Arjuna and Krishna manifest itself again. Bhagavad Gita has already taken place. Battle of Kurukshetra is nearing, you know, the total completion after everything has happened. And, I mean, it's basically over, but, you know, there's few wrap-up details, so to speak, as the storyline would go. But here, he's in that same position as when he's on the chariot. He's expressing his doubts to Krishna again. This Brahmastra that has been manifest, you know, it's not something he expected. It, you know, Arjuna has his doubts once more. This is an interesting thing, because this is not the first time Arjuna's had doubts in his relationship with Krishna. It's not the first time he's gone to Krishna and presented them. And it's, again, corrected. We should not be so hard on ourselves when we find that we're struggling and having difficulties again and again and again. Now, if it's because we're stupid and keep doing the same thing over and over and over, in business circles, there's a slogan. Matter of fact, we have it on the in the break room at my work. It says, you can't expect to change anything if you keep doing the same thing the same way. So if we're finding ourselves in the same difficulty because we're making foolish decisions, that's one thing. But if we genuinely come into circumstances where our doubts are, where our doubts arise, and we present them to the Lord, well, this is happening during Arjuna. This is the process we should follow. But as the purport points out, the real goal in this line of questioning from Arjuna is that it's coming after the glorification of the Lord. He spends these verses speaking about how wonderful the Lord's activities are and how he manifests in the world. So he's praising him and then presenting his question. And this is what Prabhupada says, you know, that mood of appreciation for who you're presenting your question to has to be there. Now, you know, I was gathered with a few devotees last night and we had this discussion on this. When Arjuna understood what Ashwatthama had done, he figured, okay, I'm going to make Ashwatthama pay. This upstart, this young student of Drona, and son of Drona, I'll easily get him. And rather quickly, Ashwatthama did find himself pinned in, so to speak. But then, as they say in the vernacular, he pulled an ace out of his sleeve, and he threw the Brahmastra weapon. And Arjuna was like, oh, well, I didn't see that coming. That's a twist I wasn't expecting. And he didn't know how to deal with it. So, you know, his idea, I'll conquer Ashwatthama, I'll cut off his head, Draupadi, you'll stand on the head and then take your bath. These are real Kshatriyas. This is a warrior mentality. I mean, you know, standing on the head of your opponent and taking your bath. I mean, I don't know how many ladies are interested in doing that, but it's it really shows an intense type of warrior. This pastime is not for the weak of heart, let's be honest, you know. But Ashwatthama gets cornered, and then, you know, he pulls out the Brahmastra. It's interesting, the verse describing his executing the Brahmastra. First he says Achman. Very important. Achman should be said before performing any sacred activity. I mean, technically you're supposed to say Achman before you start your japa, before you read Shastra, before you say a Gayatri, before you take Prashad. I mean, there's a whole list if you want to get real particular. But especially if you're going to invoke a mantra like the Brahmastra. So he sits down, he says Shastra, says Achman, and then he concentrates very carefully, no doubt recalling the mantra he has been given, and then invokes that mantra and the weapon. This is some Shakti. This is some Shakti, that by merely drinking some water, concentrating and speaking some words, you can invoke the Brahmastra weapon. Misguided Shakti, but nonetheless, extremely powerful. So Arjuna, caught off guard by this, what does he do? He turns to the master of all mystics, to Sri Krishna, for shelter. Radha Gopinath Prabhu and I have been friends for some 40 years, something like that. We've known each other forever and ever. And many, many years ago, he gave me a good piece of advice. He said, sometimes when the Brahmastra weapon is approaching you, the best thing is to just bow down, which is what Arjuna does. He bows down. He submits himself to Krishna. Krishna, I can't do this. You need to direct me, guide me here, give me shelter. So Radha Gopinath would tell me, sometimes as an individual in life, when that Brahmastra weapon, whatever it appears as, comes before you, just bowing your head and letting it go over the top of you while you're taking shelter is the best thing to do. Now, what happens next? We'll leave that for the verse speakers that are to come, because that's the verses for the next couple of days, and we'll let that story go there. But as far as incarnations, when the Lord incarnates into this world, he never comes alone. Just like when he appears as Krishna, he appears with all of his different associates. There's so many wonderful descriptions of how Krishna talks to the different devotees in the spiritual realm. I'm going down. You want to come? No, please come. I don't want to go by myself. Anyway, Goswami's right on these different types of conversations. So when Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu comes, he brings the same friends as Krishna, but they come in different roles. Kavi Karnapur mentioned in his Gaura Gunadesha Deepika in verse 71, Lord Aniruddha, the fourth member of the Chaturvyuha, appeared in Gaura Lila as Vakreshwar Pandit. Lord Krishna personally entered his body and caused him to dance. Today we're celebrating, as you've guessed by now, Vakreshwar Pandit's Lila. Now, this is also confirmed in Vishnu Chakravarti Thakur's Gaura Ganasarupa. He mentions in verse 183, that person who was formerly Aniruddha has appeared as Vakreshwar Pandit. So two great acharyas who have written each a book, Who's Who in Krishna Lila and Who's Who in Gaura Lila, have confirmed that he's Vakreshwar Pandit is Aniruddha. Now, Vakreshwar Pandit was with Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu for his pastimes in Navadvip and for his sannyasa lila pastimes in Puri. During the time of the Lord's residing in Jagannath Puri, he continued to live with him there as well. He transferred his residence to Puri to stay with the Lord. He was particularly known as just a prolific, proficient, amazing dancer. Any adjective you want to word, as some of my friends that know me, fabulous. A fabulous dancer. And he was a great kirtanir also. And he could dance, and did indeed, for 72 hours nonstop. Let that sink in for a moment. That's 3 days nonstop. You know, we'll have like Radhastami is a big one. I don't know how we're going to do Radhastami. This is really going to be a challenge. Anyway, that's a different subject. Radhastami, Bhadra Prabhu's kirtan is just like, I mean, it's the highlight of the entire year. And I mean, a couple of hours, everybody's just going wild, crazy, dancing and chanting and glorification. And then when it's through, everybody's totally exhausted. Okay, that's 2 hours. Let's tack another 70 on to that. These are spiritual personalities. Now, while Vakreshwar Pandit would dance, Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu would sometimes catch hold of his feet. I reversed it. My apologies. While Mahaprabhu would dance, Vakreshwar would sometimes catch hold of his feet. Although the Lord would sometimes change roles in these ways in very intimate dealings. But anyway, when Vakreshwar danced, Mahaprabhu would sing and Vakreshwar Pandit would grasp Mahaprabhu's feet and offer the following prayer. O moon-faced one, give me 10,000 Gandharvas and let them sing while I dance. And then I will be happy satisfying you. And Mahaprabhu would say to him, he said, you are one of my wings. If I had another one like you, I could fly into the sky. Of course, we all know you can't fly with one wing. You know, if a bird loses a wing, then, you know. So there's an example he's saying, if I had two Vakreshwar Pandits, I could fly. So when Mahaprabhu began his kirtan lila in Navadvip, Vakreshwar Pandit was a very important part of that pastime. Very important singer, very important dancer. And it was actually by Vakreshwar Pandit's mercy that Devananda Pandit was delivered from the anger of Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. The anger. We don't often hear about the anger of Mahaprabhu. There are a few pastimes. But he was, Devananda was a very prominent scholar and speaker on the Bhagavad. And one day, Srivas Pandit came to hear it. And upon hearing a particular subject matter, he became completely overwhelmed and fell to the ground crying and rolling like this. And so some of Devananda's, let's just be polite, less advanced students, oh, this guy's a disturbance, they threw him out. Srivas Pandit, toss him out, he's no good. So Devananda Pandit didn't do anything to stop this. Yes, he was disturbing. I let him be removed. And he just continued on. Now, of course, you know there are two types of Bhagavat. The person Bhagavat top, the person Bhagavat and the book Bhagavat. All throughout our shastras, the person Bhagavat is considered so, so important, so glorious. So this offense was committed by Devananda, technically by his students, but because they were his students, he inherited the offense as well, and he didn't stop them. And Mahaprabhu became very angry with him, was not going to give him any mercy, any blessings. And one time, in the evening time, Vakreshwar Pandit was performing kirtan. And there were big crowds. Vakreshwar was just... I don't know if we can picture in our minds the dancing of Vakreshwar Pandit. But we've seen amazing dancing within our ISKCON society. So we can get an idea. So he was performing these just incredible pastimes. And the news got out, and just hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of devotees came, and they were getting in very close, and it was hampering Vakreshwar's ability to dance in a very free and unabashed manner. And so Devananda saw what was manifesting, and with one big rod, like a bamboo, like a chokidar, he kept the crowds back so that Vakreshwar would not be impacted and could dance unrestrictedly. And it mentions in this way he danced for 6 hours. Yeah, a mere 6 hours. Just 6 hours. 6 hours. So when he finished dancing, he sat down and Devananda came to him and offered his obeisances at his lotus feet. And Vakreshwar became very pleased both with the service he had performed during the kirtan and with Devananda's mood. And he blessed him. He said, "May you attain devotion to Lord Krishna." And so in this way, from that blessing of Vakreshwar Pandit, Devananda's heart became very pure. And Mahaprabhu eventually gave him his blessing. He said, "Because you have served my devotee," this is such an important point. Mahaprabhu said, "Because you have served Vakreshwar Pandit, I have taken notice of you." In other words, the Lord notices us when we serve the devotees. When we give service to a Vaishnava, the Lord takes note of that. And because of this, I have given you my mercy. I mean, we could do an entire class just on that point alone. Well, mentions of Vakreshwar was imbued with a very transcendental energy. I mean, of course, one would have to have unlimited transcendental energy to dance like that for that length of a time. Now, an interesting point, Vakreshwar Pandit's most prominent disciple was Gopal Guru Goswami. And Gopal Guru Goswami's most prominent disciple was Dayanachandra Goswami. And he has written a book in which he very clearly describes that Vakreshwar Pandit was the Gopi Tungavidya. And Prabhupada quotes this in the purport, in the Adi Lila, in the Chaitanya Charitamrita. So this is another one of those examples where we have different personalities being attributed to different people, all from very authoritative sources. And I have no conclusion one way or the other. Vakreshwar Pandit's worshipable deities were Shishi Radhakanta, and they're worshipped in the home of Kashi Mishra. Excuse me. He worshipped them in the home of Kashi Mishra, and those deities are kept in Puri now at the Gambira, the place of Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, and to this day they're still worshipped. So when there's an ecstatic kirtan and we want to feel the ecstasy of dancing, we feel a little bit tired, within our mind we can call upon the mercy and blessings of Vakreshwar Pandit and then be able to dance longer and longer and longer. So we'll finish there today. I'm going to abruptly finish as I started because I have a very short time to be at my occupational duty. So thank you very much for this opportunity. This is actually the first class I've given during the lockdown. So I'm very grateful to get this opportunity, and thank you all very much. Srimad Bhagavatam Ki Jai, Vakreshwar Pandit Ki Jai, Gaura Premanande.